Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, Greenhorns. This is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers. I'm your host, Severin, and today we have Natalie Kilmer coming to us from the Bay Area, where she is working in many matters of gray matter and gray water matter. Welcome to the show, Natalie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Would you mind giving a little introduction to yourself and your work there in the Berkeley Bay Area?
Sure. So I live in Oakland, and I have a edible landscaping business in the greater Bay Area, where I focus on edibles and medicinals. And then I also work with Graywater Action and help teach basically graywater, rainwater catchment, composting toilet workshops in Northern California.
So it used to be that Graywater Action was called Graywater Gorillas. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that grassroots work has changed over the years and a little bit of the state of the scene of graywater in California?
Yeah, well, so I've basically been working with Graywater Action over the last couple years, and then I interned for them a few years ago, and I did their installers class about 5 years ago. And so Graywater Action was originally Graywater Gorillas, and that was basically, it changed to Graywater Action in 2009. I should have you talk to Christina, because she's here, and she has worked there a lot longer than me. But, yeah, basically, the codes changed. A lot of stuff in California.
The building codes, the building codes changed in California, huh?
Yeah, so in California, like, it used to actually be illegal to do some graywater projects, and now it doesn't even require a permit for laundry to landscape, which is one of the easiest to do. And with Graywater Action, we have a focus where we do more of a low-tech installations and just recommend things that are less moving parts, less things will break, and also lower cost to maintain and install.
So let's talk about what does it take. I mean, what does it mean if you have a job? So if you're able to have two jobs, one is your own business and one is working for another business, and they're in related fields, but that sounds fun. As a career, should have a nice split like that. But can you explain maybe some of the actions and activities that it takes to install the graywater and what it takes to become proficient in that?
Yeah, well, I definitely recommend people that are interested in educating themselves or homeowners to take a Graywater Action webinar or workshop. Now we're in both Northern California and Southern California. The founder, Laura, is down in SoCal right now. And I think, so to install a laundry-to-landscape system, there's the laundry-to-landscape, which can be fairly simple, but there's, like, some guidelines that you need to follow. And a lot of, you know, just things that the health department's always concerned about contaminating the water supply. So we always try to teach things in a way where we're going to protect not just the people at their home, but we're also wanting them to, you know, follow larger guidelines that, you know, they don't put their neighbors at risk or anything like that. So there are some guidelines that you need to follow, even though the laundry to landscape doesn't require a permit. But to do many of the systems, like to do a branch drain would be anything in the house except for the toilet, obviously. and the kitchen sink technically in California right now. Some states the kitchen sink's legal, and so the branch drain is a gravity-based system versus the laundry to landscape. You can use the pump that's inside of your laundry machine. So that can, we're trying to, like, not incorporate any parts that would be duplicate, so we don't need another pump if you can already use the pump in your laundry machine. And, you know, you want to use, like, a three-way valve, so that there's, you know, you don't want to be sending out bleach or, like, poopy diapers to the plants in your garden. So there's a lot of kind of guidelines like that that are kind of, like, fail-safe just to keep the public safe.
I would have thought poopy diapers would be great for the fruit trees.
I know poopy diapers can be really great for the fruit trees. The health department is just, you know, concerned about people being irresponsible with that and, like, if that water delighted. So, like, the other thing with gray water is you can't hold it more than 24 hours legally. It has to be used within 24 hours. So no holding tanks, because a lot of people want to do that. And then there are some really high-tech systems where you have filters and you can put it through drip systems, but generally most of the systems that we teach, the low-tech versions, wouldn't go into drip systems. They'd go into, like, mulch basins, and it's all separate.
Can we talk about the volume of water and, like, you know, if you're a typical residential house and you have, say, three roommates and... like, how much garden that waters?
So it totally depends on what type of laundry machine they have, right, if we're talking about laundry to landscape, because that's the only one that you can install technically without a permit. So homeowners can do it. And so if you have, say, three housemates, and usually some people do a wide range of laundry. Like, some people have done up to, like, 11 loads for just two people in a week, and some people just do, like, one a month. So it totally depends on how many loads of laundry you do. If you have a top-loading machine, that's, like, generally tops out at about 50 gallons, but average about 45. And then if you have a new front loader, those sometimes weigh everything just based on how much volume the clothes take up, and then the water kind of matches that. So just use, like, a couple gallons, the newer ones. And then, like, if you have a top-loading older machine, that could really, you know, water a lot of fruit trees. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And I guess I didn't realize that it could take 50 gallons to do a load of laundry. I mean, that's just a heck of a lot of water.
Well, yeah, I know. It's incredible. And then that's something to take into account, like, you know, do you have a lot of fruit trees already, or are you planning to do that? Or, like, do you just have a space where you really don't have anywhere to use gray water? Or, like, if folks are in a really urban area with a lot of concrete. So there's all that to take into account, like, if you're thinking of getting a new machine or not, you know.
So when you're approaching this as a designer and you're engaging with clients who are interested to do edible landscapes, what is your toolkit of, what is, like, your rhetoric that you use when you are trying to help them decide what to do? And, you know, I know that in Los Angeles there was a really amazing incentive program to remove lawns. Yeah. And that made a great opportunity for people doing native plants and xeriscaping and edible gardening, because basically homeowners got paid money per square foot of lawn that they removed. But maybe you could just reflect on, yeah, the conversation that you're having with your client.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, a lot of folks I talk to are really interested in gray water, and then I think a lot of it's just education, because people sometimes have unrealistic expectations regarding it, or just don't really know the legalities of using gray water. So I always try to come at it from, you know, a standpoint that's going to put them, like, you know, in a good position if people want it to further down the road sell their home, and, you know, they don't want it to be a liability issue if they did something that wasn't kind of the best design. And then I'm also trying to, you know, think about, like, what type of system they can actually maintain, because, like, one of the main questions is, can we water our lawn? Like, a lot of people still want to water their lawn with gray water, and it's not really feasible because with mold basins, you'd have to only water. It wouldn't work with a lawn. It only really works for large perennials or larger plants. So it just is definitely talking with people and figuring out, like, if they're. I think that, like, gray water can be adapted to anyone in the state of California and across, you know, the United States or the world. Like, it's pretty simple and straightforward, but I think a lot of the things that we're used to in our society, like, kind of are a little bit backwards. So it's kind of like we're getting back to nature, you know? Yeah.
Well, there you are on the front lines trying to reacculturate our expectations to be more logical. Thank you for doing that difficult work. Good thing you're charming and persuasive.
Thanks. Yeah, that's fun.
So each load of laundry is somewhere between 50 and 1 and 3 gallons of water, and that goes kind of a long way in landscape. Certainly, that does. If you have 50 gallons a week coming just from your washing machine, that would probably do what, like, at least 2 fruit trees, right?
Yeah. Well, let me calculate that for you. So, I mean, I think minimum for, like, a young fruit tree around the bay, so say around here, I think you could probably get by with, like, 15 gallons a week for a young fruit tree a week. So you could split that up between a few with the 50 gallons a week. But then, so say if we're in a hotter climate, it's all totally catered to our microclimates or where we're at, right? So, say, inland, a little bit in Sacramento, that same fruit tree would probably need a lot more water, just based on the heat.
And let's talk a little bit about toxins and what your practices are and how you kind of counsel people about poison in their land. Mm-hmm. Probably if they're using gray water, it's going to make them a lot more sensitive about what goes down the drain. But there's also the consideration of what's in the land. How do you, as a practitioner, approach that?
That's a great question. Well, I think that even plays in with the gray water, too, because people have to change what they're using. Like, they have to use biodegradable products and products without a lot of salt or boron, because those are will kill plants, not necessarily right away, but over time, they'll accumulate and will kill the plant. And then just in an urban area that's been settled for a while, there's lead in the soil, especially around building edges. And then...
What about the land itself? Do you do testing as a matter of protocol, or is there any requirement?
I do testing.
I've done
different types of testing. Like, the standard test that I'll do for clients is we'll test for nutrient levels and then also lead. And then that kind of indicates us, like, how much we have to amend the soil. And then, I mean, with lead, I mean, I've also asked the Ecology Center in Berkeley is a great resource. They have done a lot of research about lead, so there's a lot of ways to amend it. I mean, over time, like, the more things we bring in to amend the soil, it just lessens the parts per million of lead. But the main risk for lead is, like, women that want to get pregnant or kids under 6 or women that are breastfeeding. So other than that, if you're, like, older, you know, it's not as big of an issue. But lead is kind of the main thing to look out for. I mean, there are, like, a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things in our environment already, just being in the city or wherever we are. But, yeah, I mean, plants are pretty resilient, and I do kind of think that, you know, if we take care of where we're at and amend the soil, that, you know, we can build the soil back up. We can regenerate our environment, and that's really inspiring to me.
Yeah, well, we made a movie about land in Philadelphia, and actually we filmed part of it, kind of cheated, we filmed part of it in Baltimore also, and it was all about how the soil will stay polluted until it gets healed, I guess the name of the movie was The Solution to Pollution is Life.
And that there's a one paradigm of thinking is that you would kind of remove the soil, and another paradigm of thinking is that you would improve the soil and enhance the biology in the soil so that it sequesters as much as possible of those materials, because they're not really going away.
Totally, yeah. Well, that's really cool. I haven't seen that movie, but I would love to. What's the name of it again?
Oh, you can see it on the internet at it's ourland.tv.
Oh,
and
cool.
It's already kind of old now, that movie, but it's still there.
Nice. Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, so there's like removing it, which people can do that, and people get really concerned. I kind of, yeah, I love to build the soil. I mean, I'd rather do that than remove it and put it in the landfill, because then we're just creating another problem.
So what else should we talk about? What else is on your mind in the Oakland urban gardening scene these days?
I'm really into mulching. I would just love it. I feel like I have a hard time convincing people to lay down mulch annually, or even just to not like take the leaves that fall and put them in a compost pile, but, you know, sometimes just leave them in certain places in their yard or away. I feel pretty passionate, and I'm always surprised that people aren't more into mulching. I mean, a lot of people are, but I meet a lot of people and their gardens aren't mulched. That's something.
Yeah, you know, you never would believe some people. You think, of course they'd be the mulching type, and then they're not. Shocking.
Yeah, or even just like, you know, I try to tell my clients, I'm like, you guys, let's mulch. Like, it even sequesters carbon and this and that. And I just feel like there's a gap. Like, there needs to be like a PSA on mulch or something.
So one of the things that is true about having a really cool life and profession is that you have to figure out how to make it work in an economy that's not always into doing things the cool way. I wonder if you wanted to reflect on what it's the experience of being a small business person.
Yeah. Well, I have learned a lot just having a small business and met so many inspiring people, and it's been really cool in the Bay Area. I've had a lot of support, like the Women's Initiative, which I think closed down. They helped me write my business plan, and then I've been working with Pacific Community Ventures in the Bay as well, and businessadvising.org. So there's all these, and the Sustainable Economies Law Center. There's all these like opportunities and people that want to like give back to the community and support things that are, you know, have a different take on things, or small businesses. So that's been really awesome to have all the support. And I also just think that I was kind of, you know, I didn't really want to go into more debt I love learning, so I wanted to keep learning. And, you know, I had to learn a lot of things that I didn't really feel that passionate about, like bookkeeping and what else did I have to learn? Like keeping up my website and stuff like that is not really stuff I really wanted to do, but it's been a really cool way to learn about it in a way of necessity. Like I had to do that so that I could get along with my accountant or that kind of stuff.
And it's not rocket science, it turns out.
No, it's not totally rocket science. It's, like, kind of frustrating. But, yeah, it's totally not that crazy. And sometimes it's a nice break from all the physical labor. And it's kind of satisfying when I get things more organized. It's been nice.
Well, yeah. it always, whenever we're doing our books, and we've just been doing a lot of books lately in Greenhorn's world because we are running tight in our books right now. And you know, it astounds me that the global economy can deliver such cheap food when I see all of the costs of production that go into, you know, putting up an exhibit about a sailboat. And or whatever it is, installing a festival, I'm just like, how can these companies possibly afford to deliver this terrible food for such a low price? You know, like, or this coconut water from across the world. You know, it's really incredible that they're, these two economies are running in parallel.
It is. It's always a shocking way. I used to work at the farmer's market, and people would complain about, like, oh, my God, these carrots are $2, and they would get upset about it. And I was just like, oh, my goodness. Like, it was really, those carrots are work to grow. So, yeah, I totally relate to what you're talking about. And I think it's just, well, isn't that always the thing, like, that people, like, the main indicator of a revolution is, like, really high food prices or something like that?
Well, and yes, and that seems like a reason why it's likely that trade policy and ag policy and food policy will likely continue to have price pressure downwards on food prices because of that exact issue that, like, that the honest cost of production has been this farmer's struggle for decades, and we have not, we as farmers have not had the political power to achieve that goal for some very compelling political economy reasons. So, okay, what's their vision? If you get your way and if you look around at what's happening that's on the good side in urban agriculture in Oakland, in the Bay Area, can you just give a tiny short version of how things unfold in the next 10, 15 years and all that is possible?
Wow. Well, I mean, there's already some cool stuff happening, like they're changing laws about, you know, the kitchen sink is for gray water is moving in the direction of legal, and it's legal in other states. And I mean, I think that it would be great if people could kind of, you know, maybe not be so focused on, like, highly manicured, ornamental gardens that aren't appropriate necessarily based on water requirements. I mean, I guess I love the idea of, you know, it doesn't necessarily all have to be edible. I think everyone could grow a large majority of the food that they eat. I also think that, you know, some people, that's not their interest, but maybe if they could conserve more water. And I think that it would be really cool if, you know, I think Berkeley has some really cool stuff going on, like how they, people are really excited about the compost, and then city members can come and, you know, use that compost that was cured by the city in their gardens. So I think that that's a cool connection, and I think if that, you know, were to spread around, and if some laws continue to change requiring new buildings, and which is happening in, I know, Marin and SF, to new development projects have to basically incorporate gray water. I feel like, yeah, composting is somewhat mandatory in some areas, but, you know, getting the rest of the people on board with that, and I guess, I mean, I feel like for people to just be more connected to what they're eating and what it actually takes to grow it, I feel like that would be cool. I always like the idea of less blowers and, you know, just listening to what's going on in the natural world, like not trying to force so much.
You mean like leaf blowers?
Yeah, like leaf blowers or, like sometimes here in Oakland, like in the hills, like people, you know, I'm like, this is Oakland. Let's like worship the oak tree, you know, and people, you know, aren't necessarily paying attention to like, what is our native habitat here? Our native, and that's all changed over time, but there's ways we can bring it back in certain areas of our lives.
Well, that sounds like a good plan, and I'm really glad you got your fingers stuck onto it. And I know that that's a very lively community. Sometimes, sometimes when I go to the Bay Area, I just can't believe how cool it is. And sometimes I think, come on, cool people, go to other places. But then sometimes you go other places, and it's just as cool as the Bay Area. And you're like, Bay Area thinks they got it all figured out. So what's my point? No point, really. Wherever you are, there's something to do. And thank you for being on the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, everybody. And I want to make sure that you know we have a big festival coming up this summer in the Adirondacks in Lake Champlain, 3 days long. Our partners in Draft Animal Power and our partners in agroforestry will be presenting beautiful workshops. We have parties at night. We have beautiful community meals in the grain halls. We have lectures, farm tours. There's going to be apples. There's going to be a mill, a tour of the mill. So pretty much if you were thinking about exploring the Champlain Valley and the bumpin' young farmer scene up there, come see the new Greenhorns headquarters and our library and the scene and the fairgrounds. And, you know, you got an invitation. It's September 16th through 18th, and everybody's welcome. It's very modestly priced. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.